Okay, so today I want to do a second, make a second pass at the topic of dukkha. And like we just said, like I just said, learning involves successive approximation. There's no end to learning. There's no end to beingness. There's no end to soul evolution. And in a very deep way, which I may get into now, when Ra said understanding is not of your density, meaning not native to fourth to third density veiled mind, which I've talked about many times, that reality affects our capacity and our understanding of anything, including dukkha and these existential principles or principles of existence. And that gets us into all sorts of very interesting matters, like something called doxic assumptions. Doxic is not toxic. Doxic is not toxic. And if you, I'm not going to get into that too heavy right now, but I should later. Wikipedia has a page on doxa, which is a Greek word, doxa, doxa. Doxa, from the Greek, dokein, to appear, to seem, to think, to accept, meaning common belief or popular opinion. Also manipulated by sophists to persuade the people, used by Greek rhetoricians to form an argument using common opinion. But it's basically collective and individual subjective opinion. And the question was asked, how can it be that sukha is dukkha? How can it be that everything is dukkha or all experience is dukkha when Gautama has similar kind of experience? He's thinking, he's walking. Is he in constant suffering? No, presumably. Clearly, we experience some degree of pleasure. To say that it's all dukkha, if we have a inadequate understanding of dukkha, which is inevitable, we'll have only a partial understanding, gets confusing. And so I want to, from that kind of free form laying the table a little bit in a kind of disordered way, I want to do a second pass at the page Access to Insight about dukkha, particularly explaining, and this may go to a series that goes on and on, particularly explaining how a couple of key deeper understandings of dukkha will help us understand a little bit more what is meant that what is meant by Gautama's first, the no first noble truth, the existence of dukkha, and the second noble truth, the cause or causes or causal matrix to dukkha, how it can be understood that it's basically a feature of unenlightened mind relating to phenomena in a distorted way. So from that first page, and then how that is difficult to understand with our personal overlay of opinion associated not only with our own personal distortions, but the very reality of 3D incarnation now, where understanding is quite limited. We have some veiling, and some of our basic assumptions, our doxic position, is very confused. Meaning we're very unaware of our unrecognized, I mean, per se, we have a multitude of unquestioned assumptions. And that's a big deal because it makes it very hard for us to understand anything and limits our ability to really. It's the cause of successive approximation. The ever close, you know, the need to keep going back again, 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 again to the same themes to understand more deeply is what I'd say is a kind of successive approximation to continued learning, which is endless. One of the reasons that we need that type of gradualist approach to learning, and we can't get totality on the first pass, the totality of learning, which is what, you know, omniscience, is because there are all sorts of unrecognized assumptions and distortions in mind. Assumptions are even, you know, a cognitive or conceptual level, but there are much deeper assumptions going on, such as ahamkara, or the basis of the sense of self, which is basically the unrecognized assumptions associated with our fashioning of subjective separative identity, our temporospatial identity, our sense of self bounded, our sense of bounded self. Our sense of self is bounded, which is ahamkara, the I maker, as Ramana Maharshi said. The very fashioning of I is the primary root of dukkha. And it includes all sorts of doxic assumptions, meaning individual, I would say, individual and collective, unrecognized core assumption beliefs that influence our understanding of everything successive to that. Okay, so we jump down. This is a metaphysical philosophy, or the philosophy of epistemology, you know, metaphysical epistemology, Buddhist ontology, Ramata metaphysics, right? Epistemology meaning theory of knowledge. How do we know anything? It seems to be always successive approximation, and in this dimension, quite limited. And that's why there's so much confusion about how to translate dukkha, the word. And that's why there's confusion about how can it be that sukha is dukkha, meaning the levels of pleasure. Sukha being pleasure, happiness, physical, mental, emotional, associated with physical pleasure, happiness, well-being, mind or love, wisdom, associated with love and joy, clarity, love, and joy, and spiritual complex, more associated with bliss and ecstasy, quite non-dual, actually. Those are all temporary experiences. They're all anicca anatta. They're all arising and passing away, impermanent. They're all insubstantial anatta, or no self, or no substantive core being of the momentary, of the experience of those forms of happiness or sukha. That very anicca anatta nature of the experiences is why it's dukkha. And that's why I always use the order anicca anatta dukkha. To truly understand dukkha, one has to truly understand the anicca anatta nature of all experience. But it's all experience from a mind caught in the three poisons of grasping, aversion, ignorance. So it goes on and on. It's not like the nature of dukkha is not a quality necessitated by the outer. It's really the way the apparent inner relates to the apparent outer with grasping and aversion under ignorance, taking the presuming the impermanent to be permanent, presuming the selfless to be self, solid, substantial nature. So, I know I'm throwing a lot of things out here. On the first page, Access to Insight on Dhamma from Tanisaro, the definition, Samutta Nikaya 56.11, we did last time to do again. Birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, death is dukkha, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, despair are dukkha. Association with the unbeloved is dukkha. Separation from the loved is dukkha. Not getting what is wanted is dukkha. Those are all very obvious forms of dukkha. Even that needs to be unpacked. And the final line, you know, even though it's pretty obvious, these are macroscopic levels of experience, right? Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, despair, which is the result of association with the unbeloved or what we don't want, and result of separation from the loved or our preferences unmet or desires unfulfilled. That's the cause of such sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, despair, which is very obvious forms of dukkha, suffering, stress, dis-ease, unwell. But that's not the whole. Because the final line here gives us takes us much deeper. And the final line here is, in short, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha. Okay. So it's not simply these very obvious experiences or mental emotional states that come out of particularly not being able to get rid of what you don't like, not being able to get and secure what you do like, not getting what is wanted is dukkha, right? Frustrated desire, obviously. I grasp but I can't have. That's clearly, you know, to dismay. Association with the unbeloved, meaning I can't get rid of what I don't like the jackhammer or the siren or screaming outside the window, problems with Skype, or this or that. Separation from the loved is dukkha, so being close to what you don't like or what you don't prefer, unable to get rid of it. Separation from the loved, meaning having and losing, obviously, having the good, the desired, the preference, and then losing it is obviously painful. Not getting what you want, wanting and not getting, of course. But the final line, the five clinging aggregates are dukkha, takes us to a whole nother level. The five clinging aggregates are called upadana skanda. And upadana skanda basically are the five constituents of the sense of self. Upadana skanda, upadana means clinging, skanda means heap or pile, constituent almost. The five, these clinging aggregates, these skandas, are the basic constituents of how we fashion ahamkara. The very basis, you know, ahamkara, which is I making, the sense of self, the bounded, limited, composite, fashioned, fermented, complex sense of self that we have, it comes out of the out of the five skandas. When there's clinging, they're called upadana skanda. And so Gautama clearly walked around in a body after enlightenment. Was he in eternal suffering or dukkha? Presumably not. But he still had, you know, he still referred to himself as a being, or he said this, you know, the Buddha, or the Tathagata. The Tathagata means the such come one, the thus come one. And that's very similar to Nityananda when he talked about himself as this one here. Not I. This one here is how Nityananda referred to himself. And Gautama referred to himself as Tathagata. These guys are out of the octave. They're free of the octave while they're living in the octave, in my humble opinion. And that's why they naturally refer to themselves impersonally as A1, this one here, Nityananda, or Tathagata, the thus come one, the such come one, because they're free of ahamkara. Because they're free of clinging, they're free of the composited sense of self. Bounded, conditioned, impermanent, you know, the sense of self associated with the three marks. Anicca, dukkha. Their sense of identity, whatever that might be, used whereby they use these words, the Tathagata, meaning the such or thus come one, Gautama, or this one here, Nityananda. They use those terms to refer to themselves because they were free of ahamkara, which means that they're no longer experiencing upadana skanda, meaning they're no longer clinging to the constituents to fashion ahamkara, to fashion a conditioned sense of self. And so the clinging is upadana, the compositing is samskara. And we might look into that today also. I also explained, we're just going to go back and forth. These are all heavy-duty concepts about the roots of dukkha, the getting to the heart of dukkha. And on the first talk, I subtitled it Core Stress. I didn't know what to put in that parentheses. So the title here, you know, is On Dukkha. And the first one, initially, in the parentheses, I wrote the word stress, which is Thanissaro Bhikkhu's definition of dukkha, which I think is the best. But then I added core, C-O-R-E, core stress. That's not better, but I think it's a little fuller than Thanissaro just saying, or just saying stress. Core stress means at the core of the illusory identity, at the core of our sense of self, a subjectivist, ignorance-based subjectivism core, at the core of the ignorance-based experience of Ahamkara, meaning I made, the fashioned self, composited samskara, you know, compounded, fashioned, fermented, composited, complex sense of self, there's stress at the core, which is why sukha is dukkha too. And clearly, in short, the upadana, you know, the clinging aggregates are dukkha, means that the very ignorance mind-based experience of the constituents of a sense of self is what dukkha is all about. And that's basically the composited nature of our limited identity, which goes all through all the six dimensions, you know, or goes up to sixth density. In seventh density, it's gone, perhaps, and Ra said there'll be no more experience of identity or memory in seventh density. It doesn't mean they've lost something. Somebody sent me an email about this. I don't think it's something that's lost. It's basically, when the drop of water goes into the ocean, what's lost? What's lost is the temporospatial bounding of its experience. There's no more bounding of its experience, right, left, up, down, this is my circumference and all that. It becomes one with that ocean. What about its memory of the progression of its water drop moving to merger with the one ocean? I wouldn't assume that's lost. I would assume it's shared with the totality of the consciousness of the ocean. And so that means there's no loss. There is no more. There is no loss of what had been called memory. It's a integration or synthesis of that subjectivist, ignorance-based sense of self memory with the totality of all knowing available in the ocean. And in terms of time, you know, temporality, meaning time, past, present, future, memory is I'm here, remembering that there then, now, not then, that kind of division is gone. And so there's an experience of the eternal present or the unified presence, which is called, you know, identity goes to presence, which is the present moment, which is all that we call now, past, present, future, is known in a present moment as now. And so that's overstanding. That's not understanding, it's overstanding. And it's overstanding comprehensive gnosis of phenomena beyond time and space, beyond, you know, now standing over the temporal progression that we experience as past, present, future, and the spatial experience of inner, outer, self, other, object, subject, object, right? The subjectivist position being I'm here and you're there, I'm in here now, you're out there then or later, that whole thing goes away. However, it's merged in a totalistic, you know, omniscience, basically. It's approaching omniscience. Okay. So that's what freedom from Ahamkara, freedom from Dukkha looks like, I'd say, regarding the epistemology of Nirvana. The epistemology of Nirvana. Somebody can rip me off if you like later. If I see that in 3 years, I'll know you got it. But we could Google, and I didn't, but maybe later. The epistemology of Nirvana, I'm sure somebody's talked about it. How can we understand freedom from Ahamkara, freedom from Dukkha? Freedom from Dukkha is the freedom from the fashioned delusive sense of self, which is freedom from upadana. While there still may be an experience of body and perception, body and sensations and perception and thought and consciousness, those five skandhas are no longer grasped. There's no longer preference of I like, I don't like. Desire and aversion are gone. That's the point. But that's only gone at the last awakening. So we have a long way to go. This is advanced, I guess. Down the page, 2 points to make on the same page on dukkha. The first is where I started, which is Gautama's core position, Tanissaro's paragraph called Only Dukkha, from Samutta Nikaya also, quote, Gautama's statement, presumably, quote, both formerly and now, it's only dukkha that I describe and the cessation of dukkha, right? Those are really the four noble truths. Dukkha being described is the first and second noble truth. The existence of dukkha and its cause. The cessation of dukkha is basically the third noble truth, and the fourth is the path, like the Eightfold Noble Path. That's all he's teaching, the four noble truths, which is dukkha and its end. Dukkha, its cause, its end, and the way. That's it. That's called path-centered teaching. If you look at that and compare, you know, 90%, 95% of New Age teaching, you'll probably see that, you know, 95% of New Age teaching is not consistently path-centered. And that's the difference between the principles of soul evolution versus the transient information that is interesting, maybe helpful, but it's not path-centered. And just as Ra said. So Ra made a delineation between transient information and the principles of soul evolution. And that's the core. And Ra said, even in their first session, it's not simply information that they're presenting, but the weighting of information. Weighting meaning some information is more important than others for your own long-term welfare and benefit, for our own transformation to increasing well-being, love, wisdom. That's called path-centered teaching. Path-centered teaching is more important because it leads to increasing freedom from distortion and pain, increasing well-being, love, wisdom, increasing gnosis, realization, increasing freedom from dukkha. Isn't that important? Of course it is. And so, you know, I don't only teach this either. I'm not a Buddha. I teach about distraction and transient information. And it's interesting, you know, I watch silly movies too. So, but I know, I want to know the way, with a capital W, Tao. And that's what Gautama's teaching, deeply path-centered. And very, very few people in the world know it. Even Buddhist monks, often today, the quality of Buddhist monks, not necessarily in the West, where a lot of the white Westerner Buddhist monks actually are very serious students, but in the East, where it's sort of like the Catholic Church, and it's kind of a social club. It's a little different. The primacy of path-centered teaching is the primacy of Buddhism, which is not a religion. It's a way. It's not a religion at all, and that's why it's classed as a religion, because people are too ignorant to know that. Academics, you know, and common consensus thinking. Is Buddhism's one of the world's great religions? Oh yeah, well, they don't care about gods. They're not interested in Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva. They're not interested in magic powers even, or worship of a deity. That whole thing came later, and it's not Gautama's teaching. It's only dukkha and the way to the end of dukkha. That's the heart of Buddha Dhamma, is understanding dukkha and understanding the way to its cessation, which is, you know, the path out of third density or the path through the octave. So that's critical. And, I mean, it's interesting to look at other things too, but, you know, it's important to know what is properly heavily weighted and what's properly less important for our own long-term welfare and benefit. The final from this page I want to read is the three kinds of dukkha. I read it last time. This is another way of understanding how it is that sukha is dukkha. And another way of understanding how ahamkara is dukkha. Ahamkara is based on samkara or samskara or compositing, the complex self, right? The mind complex, the body complex, the spirit complex. It's the complexity of those aspects of total self that is its fashioned or fermented or composite nature. The sense of self is composite. The body is composite. It's compounded, and meaning it's based on many causes. It arises from a complex of causes or a causal matrix, and it's subject to change, eternally changing, ever changing. And it's not one, it's many. So the very complex, conditioned, composite, samskara, fashioned nature of both outer objects and mental process is associated with it being dukkha. Then that clearly includes sukha. So, three kinds of dukkha, also Samutta Nikaya. Quote, there are these three forms of stressfulness, or dukkha, my friend. The stressfulness of pain, meaning the dukkha of dukkha. the stressfulness of fabrication, meaning the dukkha of samskara, sankara. And the stressfulness of change, meaning the dukkha of anicca. These are the three forms of stressfulness. Take that to the bank. Take that to the bank. And you make a big deposit and you'll be a rich fellow with a mansion and a yacht like Elmer J. Fudd. Why? Because if you really get that, or let's try to keep getting that, this teaching, the three kinds of dukkha, you'll see how, all unenlightened experience is of dukkha. But that doesn't mean it's of pain and anguish moment to moment. But it's of stress. It's of core stress. It's of deep beingness stress. It's of ontological stress. Ontological stressfulness. Meaning the very nature, ontology, of our being is in stress. Is experiencing stress. Why? Because of this. Because of pain. And the fact that it's all composited, or the mental phenomena, mental and physical phenomena both, energy phenomena as well, right? So there's physical objects, there's mental phenomena, there are energy fields, right? Non-physical levels of dimensionality, higher dimensional life. We call energy, we call light, light body, right? All light. That too. That too is fabricated or composite. And so I will look at the definition of sankhara, and Wikipedia is enough because I can elaborate. But these three forms of dukkha is how we can understand that sukha is dukkha, pleasure, happiness, joy, love, clarity, bliss, ecstasy, moments of awakening, even if they're profoundly in equanimity, to the extent that there's change, there's stress. And so the dukkha, these three forms of dukkha, the dukkha of dukkha, the dukkha of samskara, the dukkha of anicca, critical teaching, critical understanding of dukkha. Let me blow my nose. Now, blowing my nose is dukkha, but it didn't seem very painful. And that's, that's how it goes. There are lots of experiences that we would say are not dukkha, right? To say birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, death is dukkha, right? Okay, aging. So every moment I'm aging. So that means every moment I'm in pain and anguish? Absolutely not. However, every moment is experienced as a mental-emotional product, meaning the nature of experience is a mental-emotional phenomenon. Mental phenomena means mental-physical. It's basically sensation, second skanda, perception, third, samskara, fourth. Within the field of consciousness or awareness, fifth. So 2, 3, 4, 5, the second, third, fourth, fifth skandhas, right? Sensations in the body, known by perception, interpreted by the mind, which also is known by perception, and experiences compounds or thoughts and conceivings, which is fourth skanda, samskara, in the field of consciousness awareness, fifth skanda. That's the nature of all experience. And that what is being experienced, even when it includes sukha, happiness, pleasure, even love, as well as minor things like blowing one's nose, which is all during the phase of aging, you know. The moment you're born, you start aging, I guess. And until you're dead, you're aging. You're falling apart, like Michael Douglas. And so, that's a great movie, by the way, called Falling... I think it's called Falling Down. Falling Down or Falling Apart. Great movie. Very heavy. Yeah, maybe called Falling Down. So, from the moment of birth to the moment of death, we experience aging. Aging is dukkha. Now, is that the stressfulness of pain? Maybe. But, you know, the experience of aging isn't really noticeable until we, you know, get to our 40s, 50s, 60s, and so on. But it certainly is involving anicca, meaning impermanence. And so there's a stressfulness or the core stress that mind experiences by the fact that all its experiences are ever-changing. There's the core stress that mind feels by the very ontological nature of personal experience being samskara, meaning a fabrication, a compositing. Meaning, if you even look into moments of happiness, they're bubbling. they're like fermenting. They're vibrating. The stressfulness of fabrication or samskara, in certain ways, actually the stress of the ninth fetter restlessness. It's the ninth fetter restlessness, which is really the vibrating of light, intelligent energy, that works on the eighth fetter, ahamkara, or the sense of self, that leads us to continually fashion a mental experience. Mental emotional experience keeps arising and keeps being experienced and decomposing and falling away. That whole thing is stress. And again, this is not a call to, you know, go out and shoot yourself or go, you know, go into depression, because there is increasing sukha, yeah, as we continue evolving. As the seven rays become purified, you know, the seven chakras purified, or the seven rays perfected over time, there's definitely increasing sukha. There's increasing above diaphragm well-being, right? Increasing love and love and happiness, the four Brahmaviharas well experienced in green ray, and visuddhi, wisdom, panya, common panya, wisdom, discernment, knowing, seeing, getting it, hearing it, listening, communicating well, seeing people's mind, being able to connect with them, knowing, you know, and approaching basically unlimited knowing, you know. I mean, I'm not in unlimited knowing, but I've seen what it looks like. I talked about this before. I've had a hit once where I sort of, the spigot was open, and I was like, oh my God, I feel like anything I want to know, I could know. Maybe that was insanity, but I'm sure there is that state available in higher dimensions. There's sukha to that too. Likewise, you know, as ahamkara thins, and as restlessness becomes increasingly quelled, deep restlessness, right? Not just body mind, but energetic restlessness. We vibrate less. We're more still. We're more well. There's greater sukha. So that's true. And yet, the true nature of all mental conceiving, which is samskara, which includes upadana skanda, or the composited constituents of selfhood, you know, fashioning a sense of subjectivist identity, right? This is a high philosophy, but this is what other people are saying. They just can't use these words. That's what most everybody's saying, actually, when they're talking on core themes. And the reason I, you know, keep using these difficult words from philosophy or mixing up Sanskrit with English and even Greek when we get to it, like doxic assumptions, is because of their explanatory power. They help understanding go further. And so you know, what I've found. So many people say much spiritual, so many spiritual teachers, let alone regular folks talking about worldly things. Spiritual teachers use words that they can't deeply explain. Higher self. Tell me about higher self. Speak 5 minutes on higher self, okay? How many spiritual teachers can do that? Not so many. Maybe some people think it's not important. Fine. But if you want to know what it is, you better, you know, plumb the depths. Or, as Heraclitus said, you know, dig up a lot of dirt to get the gold. Seekers of gold must dig up a lot of dirt. Or go through semantics, right? The rectification of language, like Confucius said. It's great. It's important. You know, you're preparing yourself to be a teacher of teachers. If you're getting this, you're preparing yourself to be the inspirers of teachers in third density in future worlds. Consider that possibility. Or teaching, you know, to whatever extent this metaphysics is true. You know, you figure it out. I make no claim. But to whatever extent this is true, it's important. And others who will put it into their own words would like to hear it sometime, somehow, somewhere. And it's not just this lifetime. We're talking about future lives as well. And that's what we're doing. We're preparing, you know, we're learning now, which gives us a foundation for tomorrow, until eventually tomorrow disappears and there's no time. But there are three forms of dukkha. It's critical to get it how sukha is dukkha. But dukkha doesn't mean pain and anguish. There is pain, and that's dukkha. That is anguish. That's separation from the beloved, association with the unbeloved, not getting what one wants, that's pain. But that's just one level of dukkha. Then there's the dukkha of samkara, or compositing, which means that physical objects and mental phenomena are ever decomposing. What is subject to arising is subject to cessation. Now that's the dukkha of change. The reason that it's changing is because it's fabricated. And so the dukkha of dukkha and samskara and anicca. And the big samskara is ahamkara. the biggest fabrication is the sense of self. So then when we look at the page on sankara, I'll send the link. What we see from the top is sankara, term figuring prominently in Buddhism, meaning that which has been put together, a compositing. Sankara refers to conditioned phenomena generally, meaning physical objects as well, and specifically all mental dispositions, right? And here we get this is for the lady who asked for this. This is where we get to the synonym list. Sankara refers to conditioned phenomena generally, meaning anything, and specifically mental dispositions called volitional formations because of their result of volition. This is mental process, mental emotional phenomena, and their causes for arising of future volitional actions. They're formed or composited. They're the result of will, right? Thought, wills, speech, and deed. And deep perspectives or attitudes, the doxic assumptions, which are sometimes toxic, but generally doxic, meaning unquestioned deep mind assumptions, create the nature of the filters by which we interpret experience. We interpret experience, interpretation is fashioning. The interpreting of experience is a fashioning. That makes mental phenomena called thought and feeling. That comes out of deep mind biases, core beliefs. Core beliefs are doxic assumptions. Doxic assumptions, D-O-X-I-C, may not be toxic, but they're basically collective and individual assumptions that are unquestioned. So I guess I should jump to that page on doxa. From the section doxa, a philosopheme, how about that? Philosophical meme, philosophical theme, called a philosopheme. Just a little. In Plato's Gorgias, which is a dialogue, Plato presents the sophists, meaning the liars, like the New World Order propagandists, the political correctness, the cultural engineers. Sophists, who are rhetors or rhetoricians, people who screw around with language to manipulate people. Rhetors who taught people how to speak for the promise of commercial success. Aha, you mean like the abundance-related New Age teaching? Meaning that wealth is a sign of spiritual evolution? So I guess the wealthiest, who? Harriman. Harriman and the railroad tycoons, Morgan. Morgan, DuPont, and Harriman are the most spiritually evolved because they're the rich fellows of the 19th century. Some New Age people talk about that. Clearly, pretty funny. Sounds like the rhetors who taught people how to speak for the promise of commercial success. Plato presents them as wordsmiths that ensnare and use the malleable doxa of the multitude to their advantage without shame. Of course, the shameless manipulators. Look at the movie The Big Short. The shameless manipulators, they're all over the place. But the truth movement is growing, so that's nice. The shameless manipulators that use, that teach people how to cleverly use words to make money. Plato was against that too, so this is 2,000 years ago or plus. This was already going on, which is very interesting. In this and other writings, Plato relegated doxa. And again, the definition of doxa is what appears. It's basically apparent belief. Consensus accepted seeming apparent truth that is ultimately a belief that is relative and perhaps mistaken. In this and other writings, Plato relegated doxa, meaning this whole category of unquestioned individual and collective belief and apparent truth, right? What's apparent, what appears for people to be true. He relegated doxa as being a belief, unrelated to reason, that resided in the unreasoning lower parts of the soul. Okay. He said that in the theory of forms, meaning, okay, it's a you know, lower deep mind, it's deep personal mind, basically. Whether it's the lower parts of the soul, I don't know. I wouldn't say that. But there is some reason to it, but it's not well thought out. And so ahamkara is one too. Ahamkara is a doxic assumption, by the way. The sense that experience is permanent and of self-substantial nature, these are doxic assumptions. That's the point. The idea that experience is unitary, substantial, and abiding. That objects in the world and mental, emotional phenomena, and spiritual states, are substantial, abiding, unitive, meaning one thing, substantial, they have a solid self-nature, and relatively permanent or abiding, which is against, anicca. Those beliefs are doxic assumptions, and that's how we see the sense of self. We don't say sense of self. We say self. Me. I'm angry. I'm just this way. You make me angry. You hurt me. All life is suffering. All life is pain. That's not what Gautama is saying. Right? There is the dukkha of dukkha. There's also the dukkha of sukha, which is basically dukkha because it's sankhara composited. It's complex, it arises and passes away, and therefore impermanent. That's why sukha is dukkha. But ahamkara is the big samskara. And so upadana skanda, the five clinging aggregates, or clinging to these aggregates as a sense of self being ahamkara, or conceit, eighth fetter, that's the big cause of dukkha. And so... We're looking, you know, that's the point, and that's the nature of ignorance, is, Gautama said that, taking the impermanent as permanent, taking the insubstantial or non-abiding, non-self as self, taking the dukkha as sukha, taking sukha as non-dukkha, considering that pleasure, happiness, joy, love... wisdom, clarity, all well-being, bliss, ecstasy, imagining that they're without stress is wrong. Imagining that they're abiding is wrong. Imagining that there is some core nature to those temporary experiences is wrong. And that's called not knowing the three marks. Not knowing impermanence, insubstantiality, and dukkha. And knowing the nature of dukkha, it requires knowing the nature of impermanence and anatta or anicca anatta. And that's why I say anicca anatta dukkha. Because when you really know dukkha, to really know dukkha, core stress, okay, experiential, ontological stress. Dukkha means ontological stress. The base, even the nature of all knowing is limited and stressful. Even that is dukkha. But knowing that, you must know, we come to know anicca and anatta. We come to know that what seemed to be abiding is not, it's impermanent. What seemed to be substantial or of a particular unitive nature is not. That's panya. That's wisdom. That's the path to awakening. These are core truths that are very helpful. And the result of that is less grasping, less upadana, less clinging, less thirst, greater well-being as is, and a freedom from doxa, freedom from doxic assumptions. So going on, Plato's framing of doxa as the opponent of knowledge, right? Knowledge is vidya, not avidya, vidya, which is panya. True vidya is panya, right? Vidya meaning knowing, knowledge, which goes all the way to wisdom, panya, prajna, which is not different, essentially, metaphysically, no different than Greek gnosis. The Gnostics were interested in knowledge. Knowledge of what? Knowledge of true nature. True nature of self, which is called true identity, or real, you know, what we are, which is beyond ahamkara, beyond fashioning, beyond impermanence. The real nature of experience. So, doxa as the opponent of knowledge. Again, these unquestioned, assumed truths, which are really belief. Mistaken belief taken as truth. Unquestioned, mistaken beliefs of the individual or the collective taken as truths. And that's the reason why people see the impermanent as permanent or abiding. They see the composite as unitive. They see, you know, they see the insubstantial as substantial. That's because of doxic assumptions. And that's the enemy of knowledge. That is called avidya. And moving out of avidya, we go to vidya. And moving deeper into vidya or knowing, we go to panya, prajna, wisdom. Vishuddhi chakra gets big blue bright. Big blue bright Vishuddhi. And then we're on Vishuddhi Magga. Hey, the path of wisdom. The path, the fifth ray, the blue ray path, right? Pray for discernment, said the Christians. Indeed. And so, his framing Plato, right? We owe a debt to Plato, right? Plato was a Gnostic. He was a neo-Gnostic. Plato's framing of doxa as the opponent of knowledge led to the classical opposition of error to truth. So error and truth are opposite. That's pretty simple. Which has become a major concern in Western philosophy. They're trying. Interestingly enough, in the Theaetetus and the Meno dialogue, Plato has Socrates, so he's writing Socrates in, Socrates suggest that knowledge is orthos doxa. That's orthodoxy, right? That's where we get orthodoxy. Orthodox means orthos doxa, for which one can provide a logos. And Heraclitus said, the logos is what we all have in common, but men go on as if they have their own, as if their own private beliefs are all this, all that matters. Right? Everyone has the logos in common, but men prefer their private understanding. There's something like that from Heraclitus, right? Contemporary of Plato, or certainly a peer in the same field, orthos doxa, so knowledge, which is the opposite of doxa, or true, you know, there's mistaken, there's orthos doxa, which means the what's called here justified true belief. So knowledge, which could be contrasted with doxa, if we use doxa as unquestioned mistaken core belief, or core belief, mistaken core beliefs that are not true, that are false, right? Taken as truth, unquestioned, but false. If knowledge is the opposite, you could also call all knowledge orthos doxa, which is called justified true belief. That initiates the traditional definition of knowledge as justified true belief. So that's what we're seeking. We're seeking justified true belief. And people don't realize that just because I believe it doesn't mean it's false. One could believe truth. So seek to know truth, love truth, and you'll get to orthos doxa, not just confused doxa. And so error is considered in Occident, is another writing, as pure negativity. So the basis of the negative path, of course, is error and delusion and distortion and mistaken belief, for sure. They're full of delusion. They're full of, that's the path of avidya, the path of making use of the false to achieve the true. The true being seven chakra activation, which they can get eventually. Pure negativity can take various forms, among them the form of illusion. As such, doxa may ironically be defined as the philosopher's sin. And in classical rhetoric, it's contrasted with episteme, meaning the basis of epistemology, the ology of episteme, meaning the study or field of branch of learning of knowledge. And so, but this is really critical, that what people taking the impermanent as permanent, taking the changing as abiding, taking the insubstantial as substantial, taking the composite as unitive, taking the dukkha as sukha, is all the result of doxic assumption. Doxic assumption. What people assume to be true, that is actually a manifestation of unquestioned false belief, mistaken belief. And you can say all the teaching of Buddha Dhamma in terms of theory is to destroy doxic assumption, false belief. So the first of the Eightfold Noble Path is right view. Hey, that's what we're doing here. We're trying to establish right view. And so that's very important. How I got to this page on doxa, which I had never heard of before, I actually looked at something. I don't know where, I think I was reading some smart fellow writing an article on geopolitics talking about doxa, doxic something or other. And I thought, does he mean toxic? Nope, he meant doxic, D-O-X-I-C. And then we get to this whole thing about commonly accepted beliefs, or commonly found beliefs that happen to be false or untrue, based in unquestioned mistaken assumptions. There's a whole page on that here. That's a whole thing. Philosophers, Western philosophy looked into, I mean, it's the field of epistemology, which I don't know much about. You know, I'm not a Western philosopher. But I'm finding that Western philosophy helps to explain Buddhist philosophy and metaphysics very well. Western philosophy, particularly ontology, theories of epistemology, ontology, are very useful in unpacking core Buddhist terms and understanding how we don't understand, you know, moving out of mistaken belief and achieving right view. And I was thinking about this, and I'm wrapping up here. Terms that I use in a certain way are used by others, or formally, commonly, not the same. And I was looking for synonyms, you know, like synonyms of metaphysical, synonyms of existential. Because I use the word existential basically in a general sense to mean of true nature existence. The true nature of existence is existential. And it includes personal experience, but personal experience is a very limited version of totality, what is the existential totality, total nature of what is. Right? The true nature of all that is, like Ross saying, the physical and the metaphysical are inseparable. That inseparability of the physical and the metaphysical is existential. Or I use the word existential to refer to that unified, to the unified totality of what is physical, metaphysical, material, immaterial, all of it. But I looked at this page, synonyms.com, to see existential. And very interestingly, the definition of existential, this is a page on existential, right? The first thing they say is experiential. Oh, why do you do that? This is some kind of conflation of experiential and existential. And they considered the word experiential a synonym of existential. How about that? How personal they are. And so, why is experiential considered a synonym of existential? Well, it's because, indeed, under the veil, with avidya, full of doxic assumptions, such as ahamkara, and not seeing phenomena and outer inner reality or outer objects and mental phenomena as impermanent and insubstantial and stressful dukkha, not knowing all that, they take the personal for the metaphysical. They take the personal for the existential. They take the experiential for the existential. This is the humanizing of reality, the downgrading of reality to the personal experiential. Meaning, people believe what they want to believe, not surrendering mind to reality. They squeeze down reality to the preferred personal. That's why they could say that a synonym of existential is experiential. The existential for most humans under the veil in 3D, full of avidya, full of doxic assumptions, full of mistaken views, full of wrong view, taking the impermanent as permanent, taking the insubstantial as substantial, taking the non-self or the formless nature of being for the me, body-mind identified. That's why they call a synonym of existential to be experiential. Because existential, what is of existence, for most people, is nothing more than what's of me and my personal experiencing. That's the result of a doxic assumption. That's the result of mistaken wrong view. That's the result of not knowing the three marks because of not attending to self-cure from the three poisons, grasping, aversion, ignorance. Because people don't question that their sense of self, they don't question their sense of self, period. They don't realize that aham has been karma, meaning aham, I, is of karma, is karmically fashioned. And so the sense of self always changes, you know. Am I the same as I was when I was 5 years old? Definitely not. Same being? I guess so. But that being is a whole lot more than I can conceive me to be. And so people are profoundly ignorant. That's why wisdom knows how profound its ignorance is. Duh. And the fool is the one who presumes that he or she has final, vast understanding. understanding really is not of this density. And most people, under the sway of ignorance and full of doxic assumptions, take the existential for experiential. This is a very subtle matter. And so everything becomes me. And the basis of dukkha is upadana skanda. So they're in dukkha. They don't know anything about freedom from dukkha because they base experience on upadana skanda. Everything is about me. It's all about me. It's all about Mary. Oh, me, Self magazine. Oh, Q magazine. Oh. So everything's about self. People magazine. Self magazine. Oh, magazine. Smiley faces. It's good. Have a fun time. Most of them repeat 3D. All right. Have a happy time. Keep repeating in 3D. I don't think that's so good, you know? It's the valley of the shadow of death. It's not continual pain. When Gautama said the dukkha of dukkha, the dukkha of pain, it's understood that not all life is pain. But even sukha is dukkha. Because it's composite and changing and selfless or insubstantial. And that's that. And knowing that really, really well, we cool down a bit. We're less hot-headed. If you really get this teaching, or at least for me, seeking to really get this teaching that I'm teaching, really learn the teaching I'm teaching, I'm talking, it has a wonderful effect on one's whole being, I think. And don't take the existential for the personal. The personal is the personal portion of the existential. And so, just looking at this page from synonyms.com, I could see, oh, I see. Under the sway of avidya, full of wrong belief, and unchallenged doxic assumptions, people have contracted reality down to the personal. And so, this was a very interesting find for me, to see this page on synonyms and to see how they put these two together. Because really, what I experience is a small portion of what I am, or what I is. What I is a whole lot more than body-mind. And the majority of what we are is immaterial. I just talked about that in another talk. So, anyway, I think we're at the end for today. And I hope that was useful. I don't think I really need to talk more about Samkara, but we'll see. And I think we may be at the end of the series on dukkha. However, looking into the nature, the cause being upadana, right? It's not the skandhas per se that create dukkha. It's the upadana of the skandhas that makes dukkha, or that is the basis of ahamkara, false, separative, conditioned, bounded identity. The sense of self, the image of self, the imaging of a self, self-image, is the result of upadana. And maybe next time we'll look into upadana, and that, you know, gets to upadana and sankhara, for sure. The compositing, the composited, complex nature of material objects, thought and feeling, mental process, even consciousness itself, and energy fields and higher dimensional reality, all of that is composited, compounded, fashioned, put together, and therefore whatever subject to arising is subject to cessation. Core. But the real problem is not impermanence and insubstantiality. The real problem is upadana, or clinging, coming out of tanha, thirst. And I talked about this a little bit in the Views Action Path series, but this is quite useful. And I hope you enjoyed it. So we'll call it a day. Thank you, everyone, whoever's been helping with this. Take good care. See you next time. And good night.